Hi, you're listening to the Professionals Playbook. My name is Justin Lee. I'm an F-35 fighter pilot for the U.S. Air Force. If you haven't already, follow me on Instagram and Facebook at Justin Fighter Pilot, and subscribe to the podcast for newly released episodes every other Tuesday. My guest today is Captain Jeff from the very successful Airline Pilot Guide podcast. He served for over 7 years in the Air Force, flying the C-141B Starlifter and the T-37 Tweet. He was then hired by a very large international legacy airline, which we refer to as Acme Air. His over 30-year career has included experience flying the Boeing 727, the Lockheed L-1011, and the Mad Dog MD-88. Here's a brief highlight from our conversation today.
He was holding the control stick full aft almost the entire time and basically stalling all the way to till they hit the water. It wasn't until the very end that the captain was up there and he was sitting on the jump seat. And something was said, I believe, by the co-pilot that was operating the had control of the airplane. And I think that was when the bell went off or the light bulb went off on the captain's head and said, "What? You know, no, push forward, push forward." And that was when they were initiating their stall recovery, but they didn't have enough altitude left to recover.
In this episode, we talk about a day in the life of an airline pilot, differences between Air Force and civilian flying, routines, both traveling and flying, how flying has changed over the last 30 years, what the point of a flight engineer was, the future of the industry, including automation, advice for young people getting into the airlines, as well as common issues new airline pilots have. Now, without further ado, Captain Jeff. Hey, Jeff, what's going on? Thanks for being on the podcast.
Hey, great to be here.
So can you go over a big picture of your career and hit some of the highlights along the way?
Sure. I started my flying career in the U.S. Air Force. I didn't go through ROTC or the academy. I was a what they call a 90-day wonder, or some people do anyway. After I graduated from Auburn University in 1981, a couple of weeks after graduation in August, I was at Maxwell Air Force Base, raising my hand and pledging to give my life to defend our country. And before I knew it, I was whisked off and in a bus and then on an airplane down to San Antonio, Texas, where I was about to start officer training school. However, since I didn't have a private pilot certificate, I was required to go through the FishPOT program, the flight screening program for officer trainees. I believe that's what that stands for. And so I did that. It was about around a 3-week program before you start officer training school. They just wanted to make sure that you had what it would take to get into the undergraduate pilot training program with, you know, success. And so they take you out, they bus you over to Hondo, Texas, out in the middle of nowhere in a school bus. And you go in there and you fly the Cessna 172, I think, what did they call that? The Muscalero or Muscadero? I always forget the name. But anyway, basically a Cessna 172 and try to simulate what undergraduate pilot training will be like in the U.S. Air Force and how you respond to the pressure and that kind of thing. So I did that and then made it through there successfully and then started officer training school. Graduated, let's see, what class was I? 8206 or something like that. And went to Columbus Air Force Base, Mississippi for pilot training. And so that's how I started. I had a few hours of flying in my logbook before I signed up for the Air Force. But when I realized that that was the way for me to get where I wanted to go, and for me, it was not, the end game was not the Air Force. The end game was to someday get into the airlines. And so when I realized when I was in college that the best way to get there was to go through the U.S. military, I did what I needed to do to get on with the U.S. Air Force.
And then how did the transition go from you being in the Air Force to working for a civilian carrier?
Oh, well. Actually, pretty easily. When I went through pilot training, I was able to eke my way up into the higher echelon of the class. And I was a distinguished graduate, and I got to pick what I wanted, even though I thought I was coming back as a first assignment instructor pilot. But that's what everybody was telling me I would be doing. But luckily, I was just able to get up into the top 10% and get my my airplane of choice, which at that point, since I was thinking I want to fly for the airlines, probably a good idea would be to fly an airplane that has a crew, like a bigger airplane. And so I chose the C-141B, the Lockheed Starlifter, and I was off and got trained in that. And so I flew an airplane that is very similar to the type of flying that you would be doing in the airlines. And so the only little bump in the road there was after I was at Travis Air Force Base for about 2.5 years, I got a letter that said that I was being considered to come back as an instructor in Air Training Command, which I really didn't want to do. And but it was one of those things where they said, you know, unless you go out and hook a check ride or fail an officer evaluation or get a bad OER, you're going to go. And I went, okay. And in hindsight, it was a good thing because my wife's father, she's from Atlanta. They were living in Atlanta at the time, and he was diagnosed with cancer, terminal cancer. So this was actually a good thing because that got us closer to Atlanta, being in Columbus, Mississippi again. And so I was an instructor pilot for the last 4 years of my time in the Air Force. So going into the airline world, it wasn't such a major change or shock, or because I'd worked in an environment with standardization and crew procedures and crew resource management and that kind of thing. So it was actually quite easy for me.
How was it flying the Starlifter? I've never gotten a chance to ride in one of those.
Well, to ride in one is not so great, but to fly in one, the fly in one is, it's great. It's a great airplane. Just like every Lockheed airplane that I've flown, it's a very stable, very honest, just a great handling airplane for the size. The Starlifter, you know, a four engine high wing T-tail cargo transport.
Do you think it should have stuck around, or do you see it as a good thing that it was replaced by the C-17 and the C-5?
I think that the, you know, the C-5 and the C-141 were doing the mission at the time. And the C-17, I think, is a good addition to the force because it's just much more mission capable. It's capable of doing a lot more than the C-141 was able to do. And of course, the Gulf War and the subsequent wars in the desert, a lot of flying, and that kind of wore out the wing spars on the C-141. So they had to retire it. And but I think the from what I know, I've never flown the C-17, but I've flown with a lot of guys that have, and it sounds like to me that the C-17's capability is just superior.
So you moved to the civilian world, and you've been flying for the same airline ever since?
Yep. That was back in 1988. And so I just went past 30 years at, I call it Acme Airlines.
Wow. So what's a day in the life like for an airline pilot?
Well, there's a lot of variety, a lot of different ways that your life can be as an airline pilot. When you start out, for most of us, it is a life of being very junior, which means that, you know, you don't have a lot of control over your schedule. Chances are you're going to be on reserve, which means you're going to be on call. Certain days you're going to be on call, and then other days you're going to be off. And, you know, you really don't get to pick the trips that you're going to fly because they just call you up and say, Jeff, you need to come in, and this is your sign-in time, and this is your trip number, and it's going to be a 3-day or 4-day or whatever. And so you just go out there and you do it. And as you are with a company for a certain period of time, again, it depends on the airline, and it depends on the timing of everything. You know, there are people now being hired by my airline that are, you know, rapidly getting seniority in their seat and are able to, you know, have great control over their schedules, or even move up at a greater rate. You know, move up into the captain seat in incredibly quick time. So, you know, that's just kind of a product of where we are now with the pilot shortage and all that kind of stuff. But So a typical day in the life for me, I'm very senior. The airplane that I fly is the what we call the Mad Dog, the MD-88, MD-90. And I could fly just about every airplane that we fly at our airline, except for maybe the 777 and the A350. No, I could probably fly the A350 as well in Detroit. Anyway, I choose not to do that because, number one, I really don't want to do the long-haul stuff. I like flying the short, medium-haul kind of trips and staying in the same time zone or relatively close to the same time zone. I like having control over my life and, you know, looking at the trips. And usually when I bid for a trip or request a trip on a certain day or a certain week, I get my first choice because I'm number 19 out of 600 and some odd captains on my...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it's super seniority and it's really nice. So for me, it's, you know, I every month we bid for our next month's schedule and I look at it and I go, okay, that looks like a good trip. I think I'll put that one for my first choice on that day. And as I said, I usually get my first choice. So it's very, very nice. Seniority is a wonderful thing.
I bet. So are you gone for multiple days or is it just, you know, flying for a day and then you're sleeping in your own home that night?
So there are guys that like to do the kind of thing where you just go in and you fly somewhere out and back or maybe three or four legs and then you're home and then maybe go out and do the same thing the next day. In my seniority range, a lot of guys do that because they can take whatever they were awarded to begin with and then drop everything and then pick up things on a day-to-day basis, almost like you're on reserve, except for you really have control over the kind of trips that you accept or don't accept. I don't like going back and forth to the airport that many times per week. I would just as soon just go, you know, once to the airport and once back, maybe twice in a week. And so I typically fly 3 or 4 day trips, which means 2 or 3 nights away from home. And yeah, it works out well for, you know, for my schedule.
So going from the Air Force to the civilian world, was there anything that surprised you or anything that really stood out about the difference between the flying and the quality of life?
Not really. No, the only thing that is going to be different for people that are used to your life in the Air Force, and again, it's a little bit different for me because when I was flying in the Military Airlift Command, I know they don't call it that anymore. What do they call it? The Air Mobility Command, I guess. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was MAC for us. It was kind of like airline flying, in the military. And so, you know, the squadron kind of thing that you're used to, it was not quite the same because, you know, you always had at least half or more of the people in your squadron gone flying missions all around the world. So it wasn't like, you know, you're based at a certain Air Force base and you're all there almost all the time and you deploy together and all that kind of thing. So the feeling of camaraderie and the squadron family, a little bit different for me when I was in the Air Force. Now, when I went through the Air Training Command or was in the Air Training Command, then it was more like that kind of camaraderie and squadron family feel that you probably experience right now. And moving from that into the airlines can be difficult for some because you kind of lose that. You're just a tiny, tiny little fish in a big giant pond and people are, you know, the schedules are all different and you're not meeting together, you know, once a week with your squadron mates and you know what I mean? It's just a different kind of a existence. And some people have no problem with that and others I think really miss that that squadron kind of vibe.
Yeah. What about the leadership structure? You know, in the military, it's a big hierarchy. Mm-hmm. Who's your boss? How's the leadership structure work in the airlines?
Well, that's interesting. As a pilot, at least at my company, you know, we have chief pilots and then we have assistant chief pilots at each of the bigger pilot bases. And they are our supervisors, technically. But you know what? Honestly, you don't usually see them unless there's something going on in your life, like you have a family member that has passed away and you need to coordinate the funeral stuff and have help with your schedule and that kind of thing. That's one instance of interacting with the chief pilot office. Another is if you're involved in some kind of an incident or whatever, you know, you might need their help with working through that. But, you know, on a day-to-day basis, most of the time, I don't even know who who my supervisor is. I'm using air quotes because I don't really see them. They are kind of taking care of the entire group, or at least that group of pilots that are at that base. And in Atlanta, it's our largest base. And I think the last time I looked, there were probably at least 4,000 to 6,000 pilots assigned to our base. And so I'd say maybe the chief pilot office has, and I could be wrong about this, but maybe, you know, chief pilots and assistant chief pilots, probably about maybe 10 on staff there. That might be actually more, or maybe I'm understating it. I'm not sure. But now other employee groups like the flight attendants, the in-flight service, we call them, they have a lot more supervisory staff because apparently they get more involved in day-to-day things involving the flight attendants. But the pilots, on the other hand, it's almost like as if we don't really need that kind of supervisory thing. And so it's interesting. It's kind of an odd way to run an organization, but it seems to work just fine. Now, as far as, you know, middle management and upper management, there are representatives in those groups that are from the pilot seniority list, and there are others from other parts of the company. Usually the ones that are pilot seniority list people are the people that are going to work their way up in the management of the flight operations division. And so our president and vice president, vice president and assistant vice president and such are seniority list pilots or former seniority list pilots.
I could see how if you don't have pilots, you know, in that structure, you could have kind of a misprioritization and, you know, maybe, you know, they're telling you to save fuel, but, you know, as a pilot, you can't really do that. In the Air Force, it's pretty much everybody a pilot in the command. Do you see that in, I guess, call it other airlines where their leadership are not pilots? And so sometimes the decisions they make don't make a lot of sense from the pilot perspective.
You know, I don't know that for sure. I can only share my experience with my own airline, but even, you know, you mentioned like saving fuel and that kind of thing. When you are now not a line pilot as I am, and you're a management pilot, now you're kind of, you know, your perspective changes and you are tasked by even higher levels of management to, okay, look, we're spending too much money in fuel. You know, we got to get this cost down. So now we're going to really push for, you know, making best efficient use of the auxiliary power units, let's say. And they'll come up with a program to try to reduce the amount of time that we're running the things and, you know, try to reduce the amount of fuel. And these are the ones that are, you know, the pilots that are in the pilot world or part of the management chain. So I guess it just depends on, you know, what hat you're wearing. For me, you know, wearing the hat of the line pilot, getting the operation accomplished, the mission accomplished at the lowest level, you know, the actual, you know, flipping the hamburgers kind of level. So, you know, I'm concerned about my mission, my flight from point A to point B, my passengers that are going to be on that flight, their comfort and everything else. So maybe my perspective is going to be a little bit different than the guy that or gal that is running that particular department or that project.
So having traveled, you know, every couple of days for the last 30 years, do you have any routines just from a travel perspective?
Yeah, you know, you just kind of over time, you can't help but kind of get used to a certain way of packing. You know, you take a look at the trip that you're going to do, like for instance, earlier today, I was looking, I'm leaving on a trip tomorrow, a 3-day trip. I'm going to be in Wichita, Kansas overnight, and I'm going to be in Charleston, South Carolina overnight. And so what I do is I look on one of the weather websites and I look at what the forecast is as far as temperature and that kind of thing for that particular location. And it's also going to determine whether or not right now we're in that time frame, that time of the year where we are allowed to wear our summer uniform, which is a short sleeve shirt. You don't have the uniform coat. You can if you want. I'm going to be wearing my uniform coat and maybe even a long sleeve shirt because I'm going to Wichita, Kansas, and I'm going to Charleston, South Carolina, where, you know, the low temperatures are going to be in the upper 30s, low 40s. and I like to be comfortable. So, you know, I'll look, because I looked at the weather, that kind of forms my decision making as far as what uniform I'm going to wear. Now, I'm going to be one of those few out there. I'm going to be one of the oddballs, because most of the people out there just cannot stand wearing the uniform coat. And just as soon as they can dump that thing, they will, even if it means, you know, laying over places and doing walkarounds out there in the 20s. I've seen a couple of guys doing that, thinking, I don't think that looks very comfortable to me, but, you know, good for you.
And what about flying? Is there anything that you do that's non-standard to make yourself a better pilot that you recommend to younger pilots when they fly with you?
Well, so, you know, being a captain, I try not to preach and I try not to be an instructor, because, you know, goodness knows they've already been exposed to a lot of line check airmen and that kind of thing. I don't want to be, you know, that guy. But I know that the way I operate the airplane is, and the way I make my decisions is going to be something that I'm modeling and hoping that the person that I'm flying with looks at what I'm doing and how I'm operating the mission as something that they want to do when they are in charge. And that's the way, you know, we always say at our company that they don't hire pilots, they hire captains. And so when you start out, even though you're not a captain, you are basically a captain in training, or an aircraft commander in training. And one of the things that we do during that time frame is we fly with people and we kind of think to ourselves, not necessarily writing down things, but you're keeping it in your head or your hip pocket. You know, I really like the way that Captain Joe did that, or I really didn't like the way that Captain Joe did that. And I'm not going to do that when I am in charge. And so one of the things that I do, and I'm old school, you know, I've been around for with our company for more than 30 years now. And I am a big, strong believer that you have to be a master of your craft in all of the different categories, manual flight, automation, everything. You have to know everything that about that airplane, what the automation is doing, and you have to know how to fly the darn airplane if the automation doesn't work. So I probably manually fly the airplane a lot more than a lot of others. Number one, because I'm just trying to keep my own skills up. And number two, I'm trying to model that behavior for the person I'm flying with.
How does the co-pilot selection work? Are you normally flying with the same group of co-pilots, or is it just completely random?
Well, in general, I probably fly with a subset of the co-pilot group on the, you know, so you're assigned a certain position, you know, first officer or captain, on a certain airplane, in this case, in our categories, the 88 and the 90, in that base. And so now you have a certain number of captains that are staffed for that position at that base and a certain number of first officers. And depending on your seniority, what you generally tend to do is end up flying with a certain subset of that group that kind of like the same kind of trips you do. So you might fly with somebody that wants to fly early in the day trips, fly, you know, as low a number of flights per day as possible. That's, you know, my preference. And so I end up flying with a lot of people that have that same kind of preference during the week or during the weekend or whatever. So, but it's not, it's like a completely separate thing. They are bidding on their own and I'm bidding on my own. And it's just, and there's a possibility or a way for them to, if they want to, there are a couple of guys that I know for sure that put in a preference that says, if this trip meets all these parameters and it's this employee number, you know, please award me this trip. So they are able to say, I want to fly with this person, or conversely, I do not want to fly with this person. So they can actually, I don't think that was something that I could do. Now, I'm pretty sure now that that's something more recent. When I was a co-pilot, I was never able to do that. Fortunately, there were never really
softer, newer generation.
Yeah, exactly. But fortunately, most of the people were great to fly with. There were just, you know, a handful that had a reputation for people that you really didn't want to fly with.
So it's pretty amazing that you've flown with the same company for 30 years. That's such a breadth of experience. How has the flying changed in the industry, and I guess specifically to you over those 30 years?
It depends on, you know, the type of airplane that you're flying. We have, you know, airplanes that do short, medium routes, like the kind of thing that I'm doing. And it's mostly Eastern U.S., I'd say, most of the trips that I fly in and out of Atlanta a lot, or Detroit, Minneapolis, New York, and then places in between. If you're flying perhaps a different aircraft type, you might be doing more coast-to-coast stuff or more Caribbean kind of flying. And then, of course, you get into the long-haul business and you do the, you know, the stuff to South America and back, and you do the Europe stuff and then the Asia stuff. So there's quite a variety. And so, you know, that's one thing that changes based on the airplane that you're flying. As far as how things have changed since I was hired 30 years ago, the biggest thing I think for me is the way that training has changed. When I was hired, you know, you start off the first position that you fly is actually a non-flying position, a flight engineer position in a 727. That was usually the first position that you would fly in most of the majors here in the U.S. And you learned the systems on the airplane, like almost as if you could go to the hangar, take the airplane apart, and then put it all back together. I mean, that's the almost, you know, I'm being a little exaggerating a little bit, but that's the level of detail that you learned about systems. I mean, you'd learn about this valve in the pneumatic and the air conditioning system will close when the temperature reaches 325 degrees centigrade. And you say, well, how do I know what the temperature is there? Because there's no, is there a gauge that tells me that temperature? No, but you just have to know that that's the temperature that's going to activate this valve. And that's the kind of thing. The level of detail that they were giving us at that time, 30 years ago. Nowadays, it's almost like 180 degrees out. It's like, oh, you know, yeah, there are two engines and there are a couple air conditioning packs. I'm, you know, exaggerating a bit. But as long as you know what checklist, if something goes wrong, you know, where to find the checklist, how to run the checklist, and it'll take care of you. And so your level of knowledge of particular systems is much, much less than it used to be. Now, some people would argue, well, the level that you had when you started, maybe that's too much. And yeah, I'd say you're right. But now it's like almost not enough. So if something happens, something that nobody had thought of before, something that maybe there's not a checklist for, you know, you're going to be in a different position now because you may not have that level of knowledge of that particular system. So that's one thing that I've noticed. And of course, everything has shifted. You know, back in the old days, we actually were in a classroom with ground school instructors that knew everything there was to know about that system, and you could ask them questions. Now, because of economics, that cost a lot of money to run these training departments with, you know, real live humans, instructors, answering all your questions. And now they give you a little USB stick and you stick that in your computer and it's all computer-based training. And so when you are learning a new airplane, the first thing you get is some kind of a memory stick or whatever that has the information about that airplane, and you plug it into your computer, you do your own training. And then before you even show up, or actually as soon as you show up, you take a test to see what your knowledge level is. And so it's just a different world, and it's sad. I understand the economics, but I really do miss that that more in-depth, more person-to-person kind of training we used to have.
This is going to show my ignorance, but what was the point of the flight engineer, and has that been completely eliminated?
Yes. I can't think of any airplane, or at least any airliner, these days that still has, unless it's something in maybe a not a fully developed country, or a, you know, not a, a first, what do they call that? I have to use the right term. We used to call it third world countries, but now underdeveloped countries or whatever. They might be flying some of the old airplanes that still have flight engineer positions. But basically, the flight engineer was the person that was in charge of making sure that the fuel balance is just right. You're burning out of the right tanks at the right time. You're running the air conditioning system. You're running you're looking at all the health of all the systems. And so now it's most of that is just automated. So it's kind of the flight engineer has been eliminated because automation and monitoring of all these systems with all our computers and everything else take care of all that stuff. And if something is going wrong, then there's going to be something, some kind of a message to the pilots that, hey, you need to take a look at this. Something is not right here with this. And then you start, you know, taking care of the situation.
Has anything else changed over those 30 years? What about the, as an example, maybe the authority of the captain?
Well, that's an interesting question. And I have a very strong opinion about that. I think that technically the authority granted to a captain has not changed. What has changed is the willingness to use that authority. That's what's changed over the years. You know, there are situations that happen. Sometimes they're not good situations, like weather, something happens that causes the operation to grind to a halt. Usually it's weather related. And there was a time where, you know, it was the captain's responsibility to make sure that you were taking care of your passengers, that you were not holding them hostage on your airplane. You know, we remember hearing about those stories where passengers were kept on an airplane for 9 hours, 12 hours. They weren't allowed to get off the airplane. And the poor captain couldn't get his company to get somebody to the gate to open up a gate so they could get the folks off the airplane, that kind of thing. And I think that that was a symptom of the fact that the captains weren't saying, look, I'm not going to keep these people on my airplane for this long. You know, we're running out of water, food, the toilets are overflowing. I don't care who you have to call. Make sure that they're out here and they have a gate available for us. Otherwise, I'm going to open up the doors and put these people out here on this restricted area on the airport for them to fend for themselves. You know, that's the kind of thing that has gone away to a certain extent, where people are not just exercising the very huge amount of authority you have as a captain, and then hence, you know, these instances of people being held hostage in quotes on airplanes happening so often that Congress had to get involved and enact legislation that said, "Look, airlines, you can't do that. You can only keep them on the airplane for 3 hours. If it goes beyond 3 hours, then we're going to fine you a certain amount of money per passenger." And now that got the airline's attention. And so things have changed quite a bit. You know, we have a whole process that we go through if there's a big delay and, you know, what we do at this point and everything else. But I'm shaking my head thinking, if we hadn't let this happen and we had actually exercised our captain's authority back in the day, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't have to have this legislation.
Is it a generational thing? Is it the younger pilots not wanting to use that authority?
I think it might be somewhat a generational thing. I think it also might be, and I'm lucky, the airline for which I fly, they back you. If you're a captain, you make a decision. As long as you're not being neglectful or, you know, not thinking about safety, you're not committing a crime or something like that. If you're really trying to do the best job that you can do, they're going to stand behind you. However, I know from people that fly with other airlines, and especially the regional airlines, they tend to, you know, really kind of prod their pilots to do certain things that they may not want to, and they don't really get the backing that that we do at my company. So I think that might be part of it as well. I'm not sure if you can say it's just one thing, like the generation, whatever. But I think that, you know, if you're going to make a big decision and you know that you're probably not going to be backed up by your supervisory staff or, you know, the upper levels of your company, then I could see why you might be reluctant to exercise that authority.
Do you have any good stories where you had to use your PIC authority?
No, I actually don't. Thank goodness. I'm going to knock on some wood here. No, I've never really, I mean, I'm sure there have been times that I've, well, of course I use it every trip, of course, but I can't think of any interesting or anecdotal stories that anybody would think was that interesting. No.
Well, I knew you had a chance to fly a Lockheed commercial airplane, which is pretty rare these days. Do the best planes, I guess, how was that? And then do the best planes normally stick around, or do you see good airplanes sometimes get replaced by lesser aircraft?
Hey, that's a great question. And I think I know why you're asking that question, because ask anybody who has flown the Lockheed L-1011 TriStar, ask them how they felt about that airplane. Was it a good airplane? Was it a bad airplane? And I'll bet if you have asked anybody that has flown the TriStar, and I have, none of us are going to tell you, oh, I hated that airplane. It was a horrible airplane. It was a wonderful airplane, beautifully engineered airplane. It was well before its, what do we call it? Not the state of the art, the start of the art. A lot of, you know, really, really good engineering on that particular airplane. Very comfortable airplane. It was fast. It was a dream to fly and a dream to land. Unfortunately, you know, so if you ask me, that's the best airplane I've ever flown. If you ask upper level management at my company, they go, yeah, well, that doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is there were three pilots that were paying to operate that airplane, and the engines were not very fuel efficient. And so the bottom line economically is it's costing us way too much money to operate this airplane. So we're going to have to retire it. So yes, there have been really, really good airplanes retired, but you know, it depends on your perspective. For the pilot and operator of the airplane, you know, we have certain things that regard as being great, and people that run the actual bottom line of the airline have a different perspective.
What are some more examples that you liked about it that you don't have right now?
Three engines. Hardly anything out there anymore. At least in my company, we don't fly any airplanes anymore that have more than two. There was a time that we were flying the 747, but they phased all those out. They retired them again because of economic reasons. A beautiful airplane. I never got a chance to fly it, but it just cost too much money to operate. And so having three engines, that's nice. The Lockheed engineers engineered a wonderful system on the TriStar called the direct lift control. And essentially what that did was that when you were in the landing configuration, the spoiler panels would reset. You know, they would extend, I think, I don't remember exactly the number of degrees, like 6 or 7 degrees. And so that became the new zero position. And so you're on a glide path and you are maybe getting a little bit high on the glide path. So you push the column forward, or, you know, for you, the stick forward to lower the nose to get back on the glide path. Well, on the TriStar, the nose would move just ever so slightly, but not really noticeable. What would happen is the spoiler panels would end up extending a little bit more, so you'd be more like an elevator. So you push the column forward, the spoilers come out a little bit more, you drop a little bit faster, your rate of descent increases, but the pitch picture stays the same, more or less. And so now you're back on glide path. You know, you bring the column back, and the spoilers now, you know, not fair, but they go back to that new zero position, 6 or 7 degrees. Same thing happens if you get too low, you pull the column back, and the spoilers start fairing toward the fully fared position and bringing you back like an elevator. Pitch picture stays the same. It's a wonderful system. Really odd system when you first experience it, because you kind of, I think most of us get into a pilot-induced oscillation, PIO situation. It was just in the simulator, you're first exposed to this, this system, and seeing the spoiler handle move out of its stowed position, and now it's like moving around. So you push forward on the column, and it's in the spoiler handle, and it's a big giant spoiler handle in the Lockheed TriStar. It's a huge cockpit, and everything's big. And that thing's moving, you're going, well, that's weird. You know, you kind of see that in your peripheral vision, and you kind of get into this PIO. And then at some point, your brain finally goes, oh, okay, I get it. I can sync up with this thing. And then you don't have the PIO at all. And by the time you actually fly the real airplane, it's kind of out of your system.
So it definitely sounds like there's a trend item in the industry, less engines, more fuel efficiency. Where do you see the future of the airlines in the next, call it 10 years?
Well, more and more fuel efficient engines, more efficient aerodynamics and using new materials like carbon fiber to make the airplanes lighter and lighter so that they're more fuel efficient. I know that you're probably wondering if I'm going to mention getting rid of one of the pilots or all of the pilots. I honestly do not see that happening in the Part 121 airline world where you're carrying passengers. Maybe you might see a one pilot crew in the freight operation, air freight. I'm not convinced of that, actually, but I don't really think we're ever going to get to the point where we have airplanes flying, big airplanes, that is, flying around with no pilots. Again, if it does ever happen, you know, 20, 30, 40 years from now, it's probably going to be the operations without passengers. Because can you imagine? All it's going to take is one crash of an airplane with no pilots on board to completely ruin everything. You know, no, people are not going to want to get on an airplane, you know, if it doesn't have a human there to take over and, you know, use their brain to analyze a situation and take the appropriate action and, you know, land safely.
Yeah, I think it needs to be 10 times safer than a human pilot before people adopt it.
Right. Now, you know, I could be completely wrong about it, and that may happen in 10 or 20 years. I doubt it. I really am skeptical.
So let's talk about automation. How much of your flight right now is automated?
Well, the airplane that I fly is probably the least. I mean, it has a full level of automation, but it's probably the least automated airplane in our fleet, if that makes sense. It's old school. It's cables and pulleys and fly, you know, you can say it's fly by wire. And the wire that I'm talking about is like a 1/4-inch stainless steel cable that is actually actuating the physical control surfaces, actually not even activating the control surface, that activating a control tab on the trailing edge of the control surface. So when I turn the airplane, when I turn the control column, you know, cables and pulleys are working their way all the way back to the ailerons and to the control tab on the trailing edge of the ailerons. And that actually, my movement in the cockpit actually physically moved that tab. And so it's basically flying a huge 172. But we do have autoflight systems. I'd say, generally speaking, most of the people that I fly with will turn the autopilot on somewhere in the 10 to 15,000 feet above ground phase, and then leave it on throughout the rest of the climb, through cruise, through descent and approach. And at some point, and I think that most people let the automation stay on for too long. I like to turn it off in the terminal area myself so I can keep my skills up. But most people leave the automation on for ILS intercept, glide slope intercept, all the way down and maybe 1,000 feet above the ground or lower or higher, you know, depending on the pilot, might end up turning off the autoflight system. So I'd say even on my airplane, at least 90% of the time that autoflight system is engaged. And now you go to the Airbus, and my experience with this is not from an operator standpoint, but as riding on a jump seat. And every single time that I've ridden the jump seat on the Airbus product, almost without exception, that autopilot comes on at maybe not even 1,000 feet, somewhere below 1,000 feet. Autopilot's already on, and then it stays on almost until, you know, minimums before it's clicked off. And again, that's my own anecdotal experience. I do know pilots that fly the Airbus. One in particular, one of my co-hosts for my podcast, likes to turn it off, especially, you know, coming into the terminal area and early on in the approach phase, and actually hand fly the airplane. But I think he's an exception, not the rule.
Do you think there's been an uptick of accidents from pilots kind of getting lulled into complacency because this autopilot isn't good enough yet to solve complex problems. And so the pilot's just complacent, and then it dumps a problem that it can't solve on the pilot at the last minute.
Absolutely. Not only do I think that, but the NTSB thinks that as well. And the FAA begrudgingly is also kind of admitting that that is a weak point. And in fact, they came out with a, what do they call these things? A safety alert for operators, SAFO. I think it's pronounced SAFO or SAFO, that basically encouraged, didn't require, but encourage airlines to ensure that their pilots are flying the airplane manually more at the appropriate time. In other words, we are not expecting you to hand fly an ILS approach or a low visibility approach, or well, a real low visibility approach. You're not allowed to hand fly it. But, you know, they basically say, you know, if it's a nice day, the weather's not too bad, the weather doesn't require you to keep the automation on, we encourage you to manually fly the airplane to keep your skills up. Now, that's one thing to put out an alert like that, and another for your pilot group to actually practice it. And in my anecdotal experience, very few people are practicing it, and it's getting worse. And I do see a shift. More of the older generation pilots seem to be less or more comfortable with manually flying an airplane. The newer generation folks that I'm seeing seem to be much, much less comfortable with manually flying the airplane.
Yeah, just kind of becoming a system operator instead mm-hmm. of actually knowing how to use the stick and rudder. Wasn't there a airliner that originated out of South America where the pilot stalled all the way from 35,000 feet into the ocean?
Air France 4507, I believe, and that was out of, they were going from Brazil to Paris and out over the Atlantic. They ran into a storm system, and it iced up the airspeed probes. And in this case, I believe there were three separate ones, and I think two of the probes were iced over, and the computer system saw two out of three. I'm not confident that I'm getting good information here, so I'm going to go ahead and relinquish control to the human. And unfortunately, the human at the controls at the time, you know, didn't have, well, first of all, you don't have a lot of experience flying an airplane at 35,000 feet. And, you know, that's just, you know, something that is not the easiest thing to do. And he started activating the controls in an inappropriate way for the weight of the airplane, the altitude, et cetera, and demanding something that the airplane couldn't deliver. And yes, you're right. I think that he was holding the control stick full aft almost the entire time, and basically stalling all the way to till they hit the water. It wasn't until the very end that the captain was up there, and he was sitting on the jump seat, and something was said, by, I believe, by the co-pilot that was operating the had control of the airplane. And I think that was when the bell went off, or the light bulb went off on the captain's head and said, "What? You know, no, push forward, push forward." And that was when they were initiating their stall recovery, but they didn't have enough altitude left to recover.
Yeah, that's just so terrible to hear. So many people lost their life for something so basic as that.
I know.
So I guess on that note, moving on, what advice would you have for somebody new kind of getting into this industry? Say they're in college and they want to be an airline pilot.
Well, do the best you can in whatever course of study you are in college. I always recommend to people before they go off to college, and I always recommend that they do get at least a bachelor's degree. Now, of course, if you're going to go into the military flying, that's a requirement because you have to have a college degree to become an officer, and you have to be an officer to fly aviation in the military. I think there are a couple of exceptions in some services, but it's more the rule. That's the exception to the rule, I guess. So, you know, a college degree is a good thing. All the majors are still requiring it. And I always recommend that what they study in college be their plan B, because, you know, as much as you want to fly for the airlines may not want you to fly for them. And so, or you might get hired by an airline and then something happens with your health and you can't get a medical clearance or certificate and, you know, you have to do something else. So I always recommend that people study something in college, get their degree in something that they would like to do as a second choice for their career. But do the best they can, get the best grades they can. Let's see, what else would I recommend for people? You know, just keeping your flying records, your logbook up to date, and trying to be involved in things other than just flying airplanes. You know, it's kind of the whole person approach to things, just as the military looks at folks that they are considering bringing in. They'll look at not only your grades, your grade point average, but also things that you're involved in, extracurricular activities and that sort of thing. Yeah, that's about all I can think of right off hand.
What about somebody who's just gotten hired by Acme Air, one of these major carriers? They're showing up, you know, the first couple months. What are some issues that you see from them that, that you wish you could have addressed earlier?
Well, again, I don't know if this is a generational thing or what, but I think you need to understand that whatever you do in your life, whatever career field you go into, you can't expect that you're going to be the manager or the supervisor, that you're going to have to start at the bottom and work your way up. And even though you're at the bottom or you're in the airline world, you're a very junior first officer on an airplane and you have no control whatsoever, you know, with your schedule, et cetera. You have to understand that that's the way it's going to be until you're there for a while and you work your way up and you get some seniority. And then your life will improve. And the thing that I think I'm starting to see with the newer generation folks is that they don't have the patience that maybe the older generations had, you know, putting off, you know, accepting the fact that you're not going to have a super great life and control of your schedule and you're going to have to make some sacrifices, understanding that, you know, on the horizon there, or, you know, somewhere into the future, things are going to get much better. And just to have a good attitude about that and understand that.
So let's talk a little bit about your podcast, The Airline Pilot Guy. You've been doing that for over a decade, which is pretty crazy to me. can you talk about who that's for and talk about the podcast?
Yeah, it is crazy. You're right. I never imagined that when I started it in 2009 that it would be here, you know, as you said, 10 years later, still doing it and doing it every week. When I started, I was involved with a Catholic podcasting network, and I was very involved behind the scenes. I didn't have any podcast myself, and I started getting that itch that, you know, I want to try this. I think that, heck, I make PAs on an airplane. How hard could it be to get in front of a microphone and start talking? Well, I think you know that it's not as easy as you think it would be, right, Justin?
Oh, no, it's tough. Audio is tough.
It's very tough.
And you do video too, so that's even tougher.
Yeah, and we just do the video because that's just the platform that we use to bring everybody together. But so I really realized quickly that because I was part of a Catholic network, that I was going to I couldn't just do a show about flying. I had to do something related to Catholicism as well. So I called my show Catholic Pilot. I realized almost immediately that nobody could care anything about the Catholic part of it. They were all interested in my job as an airline pilot and, you know, what that involved and all that. And I thought, maybe I need to repackage this whole thing and make it a completely secular flying related, an aviation podcast. And so I did that about a year and a half point. And ever since then, I've been the airline pilot guy. And why do I do it? I do it because, well, for a few reasons. I really enjoy working with audio equipment and learning how to do things like, you know, how to do websites and how to, you know, edit audio and you know, that kind of thing, always trying to improve. Another reason is that I want to give people some advice and have them learn from my own experience and the experience of others that I have as co-hosts, so that they can have some sort of an idea of what their life as an airline pilot might be if they choose to do it. And, you know, just kind of giving people out there who are just aviation enthusiasts an idea of what it's life like to live the life of an airline pilot. And so they, a lot of people listen to the show that are just living vicariously through us. And I'm sure it's the same thing with, you know, your podcast and the life of a fighter pilot and people wanting to live vicariously through you and all of your great guests.
Well, give me a couple of years. I need to catch up to you. So are there any other projects that you're working on?
No, I don't have time to do anything but fly my trips and do this podcast. I mean, I'm as I said, I do this every week along with my co-hosts. I have a Virgin Atlantic captain, a wide body captain that lives outside of London. That's one of my hosts. A fellow captain at my airline is also another co-host, and then Dr. Steph, who is a doctor. Who is a general aviation pilot, a commercial multi-engine instrument rated pilot. And she does all kinds of things, runs marathons and skydives. And it's just amazing all the things that she does. And so it gives, you know, some different perspectives and we're different personalities, different perspectives, but a lot of good resources and a lot of experience out there for people to hopefully learn from, either in a good way or a bad way. So just so I look at it as a way for, I mean, I've had a really great career. I never had any issues getting into the Air Force and then getting out and immediately getting on with a major airline for 30 years now. And it's been a good career for me, a good life, and I want to give back. And so that's a big part of it. Just, it's such a pleasure to hear people out there with success stories who have listened for years, who didn't have any experience at all flying, and who are now flying for regional airlines. And there's, you know, a handful of those folks already, and perhaps more. That's, you know, just what I know about.
And where can people follow you and keep up with what you're doing?
Well, they can go over to airlinepilotguy.com, our website. We're also on the app stores for the iOS and Android. You can just look for, do a search for Airline Pilot Guy, three words, and there's a free app, no advertising. A good way to keep track of what's going on with the podcast and the community. And yeah, that would be the two ways to check us out. And you can learn more about where we are on social media from those sources.
Well, Jeff, I really want to thank you for being on the podcast. I appreciate you giving some of your time, and I look forward to following you on your podcast.
Well, thanks, Justin. It was a pleasure and an honor that you asked me to be on your fine podcast as well. I appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. Check out my website, professionalsplaybook.com, or follow me at Justin Fighter Pilot on Instagram and Facebook. I'll see you in 2 weeks.